like they are doing something wrong. But if you want this to stop, if you want the deluge of little hurts against people of color to stop, if you want the normalization of racism to stop, you have to have these conversations. When it comes to racial oppression, it really is the little things that count. Chapter 13. Why are our students so angry? When my 8-year-old son is nervous about something, he often moves silently back and forth at the doorway to my bedroom where I do most of my writing. If I don't notice him within a few seconds, he'll very lightly knock. When he's not nervous, he just bursts right in with no pretense of manners. We are not usually a house that knocks. But when he's nervous, he knocks. That evening, I looked up at the sound of a hesitant little knock at my doorway and saw the little brown face of my worried boy. "Mom," he said, barely audibly. I smiled warmly. "Come sit down, baby. Tell me what's up." My son sat at the end of my bed and fidgeted for a moment before saying, in an almost scared voice, "Mom, I don't want to go to my assembly at school tomorrow." My son loves school. He cries at the end of every school year and jumps for joy at the end of summer. He tries to never miss a single day or any school events. "Why, baby?" I asked, concerned. "My music teacher says that if I don't sing the national anthem and say the Pledge of Allegiance, that the veterans will be mad at me," he said, almost in tears. I was confused for a moment, but then I remembered that Veterans Day was coming up. "Are veterans coming to your assembly?" I asked. He nodded. "Yes. And my teacher said that if I don't say the pledge, they will walk up to me and yell at me and ask, 'Why aren't you saying the pledge?' And they'll be hurt because they fought in a war for me and I won't say the pledge for them." Before I could say anything, my son set his jaw and said, "But I won't say it." My son had already spent plenty of time explaining to adults why he didn't want to say the Pledge of Allegiance anymore. He had first told me months earlier, after the same nervous dance at my bedroom door, "Mom, why do we say the Pledge of Allegiance at school?" I was surprised, because even though the recent protests by NFL football quarterback Colin Kaepernick refusing to stand for the national anthem had been all over the news, it was not something I'd discussed with my 8-year-old. Although I'm a very politically active and aware person, I try to let my kids be kids and focus when I can on basic intersectional kindness instead of news of complicated public resistance. But I gave my son a brief history of the Pledge of Allegiance. He asked a few questions, and I answered them with a Google check or two on my phone. Then he took a deep breath and said, "Mom, I don't think I should say the Pledge of Allegiance anymore. Would that be okay?" All activists want their kids to magically turn into badass activists, but I wanted to make sure that this was a decision my son had come to after some thought, and that he had the reasoning to be able to defend that decision. I asked him why he didn't want to say the pledge. "Because I'm an atheist, so I don't like pledging under God. I don't believe in pledging to countries. I think it encourages war. And I don't think this country treats people who look like me very well, so the liberty and justice for all part is a lie. And I don't think that every day we should all be excited about saying a lie." So when my son came to me the second time, I thought we'd worked this pledge business out already. I emailed my son's teacher about his wishes to stop saying the pledge, and the teacher followed up with my son in a supportive conversation, and they worked out a compromise. The class recited the Pledge of Allegiance just like they always did every day, and my son respectfully listened but didn't join in. When it was his turn to lead the class in the pledge, kids alternate leading the pledge to teach confidence and leadership skills, he would lead the class in a poem instead. Now, after all of that effort to explain to me and his teacher why he didn't want to say the pledge, he was being required to say it by a different teacher. I was shocked at the thought of any teacher working so hard to intimidate my 8-year-old into compliance, but I looked at my son's face and knew that his mind was made up. I patted his knee and said, "I don't want you to miss school just because your teacher wanted to scare you. He doesn't understand why you don't want to say the pledge, but that's his problem. You've already explained it to your teachers. No veterans are going to yell at an 8-year-old boy in the middle of an assembly, and if they did, they would be really mean people. But I will make sure that if you go to that assembly and you don't say the pledge and you don't sing the national anthem, nobody will yell at you." He nodded, went to school, and was silent. I was once again amazed at how much strength and fight was in this little boy already. As a parent of a child of color, you try to shield your kids from the harsh realities of the world when you can, while preparing them for the ugliness that they don't have the privilege of being kept safe from. I remember the look of heartbreak on my son's face when our neighbor across the street said that our Black Lives Matter sign was racist against white people, not knowing that my son had picked it out himself. Another time, my son told me that his dad had said he could never play with his toy gun from his spy set outside. Best to keep it indoors, he was told. "Mom, Dad said that a boy was playing outside with a toy gun and a cop shot and killed him," he said to me, looking for confirmation of his dad's argument. That sentence, out of the blue, was like a gut punch. I had spent months trying to not think about the image of 12-year-old Tamir Rice gunned down at a park by a cop who did not recognize the humanity and childhood of a little boy. A boy who'd been left to die on the ground while his sister, who ran to help him, was body slammed and handcuffed. "That's true," I had to say. "That happened." "But Mom," my son asked, "my stepbrother plays outside with toy guns all the time. How come my dad never told him not to?" I didn't realize it was possible for my heart to break more than it already had. His dad, a white man, had likely never had to consider these possible consequences of toy guns until he saw his little brown boy playing with one, and had to change family rules to accommodate this new reality for him. I had to look at my beautiful son and say, "Well, that's because your stepbrother is white, and cops are more likely to recognize that he's a little boy playing, and that the gun isn't real. I'm so sorry, honey. I know it's not fair. Not every cop would think your gun is real, but it's not worth the risk, and your daddy wants to keep you safe." My son looked at me with tears in his eyes and nodded, then silently walked away. My son thought about the Pledge of Allegiance, and he looked at this country, and he decided that he didn't want to say it anymore. "I don't think this country treats people who look like me very well, so the liberty and justice for all part is a lie. And I don't think that every day we should all be excited about saying a lie." "Well," I said, "that's a good enough reason for me." I was born in the 80s, 1980 to be exact. I grew up with the promise of the Cosby family. If you worked hard, you could achieve anything. If you were smart enough, you'd find yourself choosing between Hillman and Yale. Yes, racism still existed, and you would occasionally encounter a close-minded fool who would ruin your day with his outdated notions of race. But racism was just that, outdated. And what you would expect, if you played by the rules, was a good life largely unencumbered by the color of your skin. But the promises of the 80s did not prevent the crack epidemic or the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994, which helped militarize our police force, introduced mandatory minimum sentences for crimes more likely to be committed by black and brown offenders, and rapidly expanded prison sizes to accommodate the massive increase of black and brown bodies brought in by a criminal justice system now incentivized to see black and brown people as criminals. The promises of the 80s did not stop the mass incarceration of the 2000s on. The promises of the 80s did not stop families of color from being disproportionately devastated by the housing crisis and the Great Recession. Even Cosby himself would turn out to be a promise horribly broken. While many in my generation and older had hoped that the election of President Obama would signal some realization of those earlier promises, it is our children who have had to inherit all the ways in which those promises fell short. We raised our children with the confidence and the audacity to reach for what the promises of the 80s told us our children should be able to achieve. Our parents taught us to strive for the middle-class comfort, safe schools, and steady work that they had fought so very hard for. Because of previous generations, we were able to give our children a freedom that we never had. And our children took that freedom to high school and college, and they realized how little difference our striving has made to the outlook on their futures. We raised our children not knowing that by the time they became adults, one in three black men would be likely to see prison, that they could expect to have 1/13 the household income of their white counterparts, that they would see hundreds of black and brown men and women shot and killed by cops every year with no recourse. We raised our kids with all the audacity and hope of generations of protest and progress, and the world expected them to be happy with the sorry state of things as they actually are. But our kids have seen that no matter what individual progress we make, no matter how good we strive to be, the system remains. Our kids have seen how every compromise we made over the decades has been turned against them now. Our attempts at respectability have been turned into barriers to recognizing our humanity. Our focus on exceptionalism has been used to justify the murder of the less exceptional. Our focus on allowing good people of color to join the ranks of good whites has allowed a criminal justice system to swallow up an entire generation deemed bad. Our children see how they are allowed in the best colleges, but only if they live in a neighborhood that has enough public school funding to help them get there. Our children see how once they get into that college, the curriculum will still teach and promote the history, culture, and politics that keep them oppressed. Our children are seeing their parents lose their homes they worked so hard to afford due to racist lending practices of banks who will never face consequences for their illegal deeds. Our children see how no matter how hard they work, no matter what they accomplish, they could still be in the next viral video as they are gunned down by a cop at a traffic stop. Our children see that as the world is now, they have nothing to lose. And our children are remembering how many times we told them that they could do anything. Our children are remembering every time we talked about the civil rights movement and the fight for justice. And they are fighting. Our children are fighting school systems that teach from racist and colonialist narratives. Our children are fighting the exploitation of student-athlete programs. Our children are fighting the language that perpetrates oppression. Our children are fighting to be seen as human beings without any precondition. And our children are fighting for more than just themselves. They have also inherited the vision and accomplishments of disability activists and of Stonewall. Our children believe that justice for people of color includes all people of color, and our children are not willing to let anything slide. Our kids are fighting for a world more just and more righteous than we had ever dared to dream of. The debates we have about gay marriage, transgender bathroom rights, immigration, whether it's All Lives Matter or Black Lives Matter, have been largely settled in the social world of our youth, and they are looking at us dismayed and perplexed at why we just don't get it. In the days after the election of Donald Trump, my older son and a few hundred of his classmates walked out of class and marched to City Hall. They were angry and frightened. They had been working so hard to build a better, more inclusive world, and we adults had just royally fucked it up for them. My son sent me a video of the protest, and I posted it online. Quite a few adults commented, "Shouldn't these kids be learning instead of protesting?" But they had been learning, far more than we apparently had, and that was why they were protesting. It can be inspiring and also disconcerting to witness our youth in action. They often ask for things that we were brainwashed into believing was too much to ask for. Trigger warnings, non-ableist language, inclusive events. As the newer generation casts us aside, it is very easy to find yourself feeling old and wrong. What happens when the youth roll their eyes at principles we've spent our lives fighting for, when they've decided that they are not only outdated but oppressive? And this is important to remember for all of us. No matter what our intentions, everything we say and do in the pursuit of justice will one day be outdated, ineffective, and yes, probably wrong. That is the way progress works. What we do now is important and helpful, so long as what we do now is what is needed now. But the arguments I was having in college are not the arguments the world needs now as I prepare to send my son to college. And if I refuse to acknowledge and adjust to that, all I'm doing is making things harder for a generation that would really like to move things forward. I've learned as a parent that I will never fully agree with or understand my children, especially as they get older. But like I did with my mother, they will find their own way. It is my job as a parent to help give them the platform they need to build their way on, or to smash once they've decided it doesn't work for them. It is my job to keep them safe and support them in the path they choose to take, and provide whatever resources I can to that end. This is the same for our role as the adult generation in society. It is our role not to shape the future, but to not fuck things up so badly that our kids will be too busy correcting the past to focus on the future. It is our job to be confused and dismayed by the future generation and trust that if we would just stop trying to control them and instead support them, they will eventually find their way. My goal as a writer and an activist is not to shape future generations. I hope to give a platform, a foundation for our young people to build upon, and then smash to bits when it is no longer needed. That is what our kids are doing right now, with all of the work we have done, all that we have dedicated to them. They are building upon it, so that they can smash it all down. And it's a beautiful thing to see. Chapter 14. What is the model minority myth? I spent my entire childhood and the entirety of my 20s poor. No, not momentarily broke where you can't go to the concert you want or can't eat out for dinner that week. I mean poor. The type of poor that cuts the electricity off, that doesn't have a phone, that eats dinners in soup kitchens. I remember trying to sleep longer so that I would have less time awake to feel hungry. I remember sneaking down the hall to use a vacant apartment to shower after our water had been cut off. But I also remember that we weren't alone. We certainly were not the only poor kids, although in our neighborhood we were perhaps a bit poorer than most. But there were poor black kids and poor brown kids, and occasionally some poor white kids. I would gravitate to other brown and black kids in my neighborhood naturally, not because I assumed that we'd have a deep connection racially, but because I felt like we'd be more likely to have a connection economically, which for kids can matter more than just about everything. Yes, I'd been mocked for my dark skin and coarse hair, but I'd been mocked far more for the mustard sandwiches I brought for lunch, the oil lamps and candles we often used to light our apartment, or the fact that nobody could call me on the phone. Chances were, if you were brown and you lived in my apartment complex, you were almost as poor as me, and you could spend the night at my house and we'd scrounge up a dollar for some packages of ramen, and if the power went out, we'd crumble up the dry noodles and eat them like chips under candlelight, and nobody would think that it was weird or shameful. I had friends you could go to the food bank with, friends who wouldn't be embarrassed if you paid for your groceries with food stamps. I had friends that never expected fancy gifts. I had friends who never looked at the label on your clothes because ours all had said Goodwill on paper tags when we got them. I had friends who never asked where your mom was because we all knew our moms were working. And because we were all poor, none of us ever had any material thing to be jealous over or petty about. We were just kids, and for the most part, we were happy. This isn't to say that being poor was just fine. It wasn't. We still felt every bit of shame that the outside world wanted to pile upon us. We still saw the worried looks on our parents' faces as they tried to figure out how they were going to make $20 last a week and a half. We still saw how much less our teachers expected from us. But when we were together, we could pretend, even for a little while, that we were the normal ones, that we weren't broken. I didn't realize until I was an adult that most of my poor childhood friends were Asian American or Pacific Islanders. My idea of Asian Americans very much fit in with the popular stereotype of hardworking, financially and academically successful, quiet, serious people of predominantly East Asian, Chinese, Korean, or Japanese descent. But most of my friends' parents were from Guam, the Philippines, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and India. Most of my friends' parents had fled war, conflict, and economic disaster. They were all poor, they were all struggling, and they were all discriminated against for their brown skin and their strong accents. But even though they were my friends, their racial and ethnic identity was invisible to me and continued to be so well into my adulthood. And so when I started fighting for racial equality, they were not on my mind. When I started fighting for economic justice, they were not on my mind. And still today, even after having spent years of my life focused on racial justice, Asian Americans are at times an afterthought in my work. I'm not proud to admit it, but it's the truth. This is not because I do not know and love many Asian American people, but that excuse doesn't work for me any more than it does for anybody else. It's because I'm a product of this country, and I'm just as susceptible to the narrative that fetishizes and erases Asian Americans as anybody else. I, like so many of us, have to do better. When we think about race in America, most of us, with the notable exception of many Asian Americans, think in terms of black and white, and maybe brown, Latinx, and white. And maybe, just maybe, American Indians and white. But we rarely talk about the model minority myth and how it affects Asian Americans. And if we do talk about it, we rarely talk about it as a problem. The model minority myth fetishizes Asian Americans, reducing a broad swath of the world's population to a simple stereotype. The model minority myth places undue burdens and expectations on Asian American youth and erases any who struggle to live up to them. The model minority myth erases religious minorities. It erases refugees. It erases queer Asian Americans. The model minority myth gives a pretty blanket for society to hide its racism against Asian Americans under, while separating them from other people of color who suffer from the same white supremacist system. The model minority myth is active racism that is harming Asian Americans, and we need to talk about it. Something called model minority doesn't seem like it would be a problem. When we think of being a model for a group, we think of being someone to aspire to. For many people in the Asian American and Pacific Islander, AAPI, community who complain about the model minority myth, this argument that being a model minority is not actually something to complain about is often used to silence them. These complaints are often met with an overly simplistic idea of what the model minority myth is. But no, the problem isn't actually that society just sees Asian Americans as just too great. It isn't that Asian Americans are just too successful. The model minority myth is much more complicated and harmful than that. Originally coined in 1966 by sociologist William Peterson to profile the socioeconomic success of Japanese Americans, the myth of the model minority has become a collection of stereotypes about Asian Americans, presenting them as an ideal minority group in the eyes of white supremacy. Included in these stereotypes are presumptions of academic and financial success, social and political meekness, a strong work ethic, dominance in math and the sciences, and strict parenting. Peterson's use of model minority was to study the success of Asian Americans, contrasting them with what he termed problem minorities. While some in the Asian American community embraced these stereotypes, many others fought against it. The work of Asian American scholars, like Bob Suzuki's Education and the Socialization of Asian Americans, a revisionist analysis of the model minority thesis, and Ki Tek Chen's The Myth of Asian American Success and Its Educational Ramifications, helped lead early pushback against the idea that all Asian Americans were destined to succeed. On the surface, the model minority myth does not seem like a myth. Asian Americans do have some of the highest rates of college graduation, highest salaries, and lowest incarceration rates of minority groups in America. But Asian American sociologists, psychologists, educators, and activists have helped shed light on the reality of life for Asian Americans that the model minority myth hides, and the real harm that it does. When we say Asian American, we are talking about an incredibly broad swath of cultures and histories representing a very large portion of the globe. When we say Asian American, we are talking about not just people of Japanese, Korean, and Chinese descent, but also South Asians, Southeast Asians, Pacific Islanders, Indian Americans, Hmong Americans, Vietnamese Americans, Samoans, Native Hawaiians, and more. When we say Asian American, we are talking about war refugees, tech professionals who first arrived on H-1B visas, and third-generation Midwesterners. When we say Asian American, we are talking about so much more than can be fit in a single stereotype. While every racial minority in the U.S. is subject to harmful stereotyping, the model minority myth becomes hard to combat when it is not seen as harmful because the people most harmed by it are also made invisible by it. So who and what do we not see when we see the model minority? Quite a lot. Pacific Islanders. The culture, history, and voices of people of Hawaiian, Guamanian, Tongan, Fijian, Samoan, and Marshallese descent, and more, are largely invisible to greater American society and culture. And the needs of Pacific Islanders are often left out of discussions on the needs of Asian Americans. Extreme economic disparity. While as a whole, Asian Americans have wealth and poverty rates similar to those of white Americans, that statistic covers up a wide disparity of wealth and poverty amongst Asian Americans when you look at the country of origin. Filipino Americans, on average, have a low poverty rate of 6.7%, more than 3 percentage points lower than white Americans. But Cambodian, Laotian, Pakistani, and Thai Americans have a poverty rate of around 18%. Bangladeshi and Hmong Americans have poverty rates between 26 and 28%, matching or surpassing that of Blacks and Hispanic Americans. Pacific Islanders have the highest unemployment rate of any racial or ethnic group in the U.S. As Ronald Takaki pointed out in his book, A Different Mirror, A History of Multicultural America, a fair amount of this economic disparity can be attributed to how Asian Americans immigrated to America over time. Asian Americans were first derided as unskilled labor until the 1965 Immigration Act prioritized Asian Americans who were more highly educated and financially successful in the belief that they would contribute more to American society. As the most privileged and skilled immigrants from China and Japan entered the U.S., the stereotype of Asian Americans in the U.S. changed to one of a cultural inclination for academic and business success, ignoring the fact that the majority of Chinese and Japanese people who were unable to immigrate did not enjoy the same high levels of income or education. As that myth took hold, it did not adjust to accommodate the vastly different social, educational, and economic circumstances that Asian refugees were coming from as they fled countries like Vietnam and Cambodia. Nor did it account for the social and economic barriers they, like many other refugee populations, would face when they arrived in the U.S. Extreme educational disparity. While in 2013, Asian Americans had the highest college graduation rate of any racial group in America by far, with 53%, as with overall numbers of economic success, this number hides a wide disparity based on country of origin. 46% of second-generation Cambodian and Laotian Americans have only a high school degree or less, compared to only 6% of second-generation Chinese Americans. The model minority myth makes it even harder for struggling Asian American students to find academic success, as studies have shown that it causes many K-12 educators to believe that Asian American students need less academic resources for their success, even though approximately 1 in 3 Asian Americans, especially those raised in households where English is not spoken, lack proficiency in writing, reading, and speaking skills. And while many Asian Americans suffer these economic disadvantages and lack of resources, they often face lower acceptance rates to colleges and universities because they are seen as overrepresented in U.S. higher education. When you add in the U.S. immigration processes encouraging a brain drain of elites from countries like China and India, the vast majority of the academic success we see when we think of Asian Americans is only available to wealthy, highly skilled immigrants who already have a high level of education and their offspring, while only 17% of Pacific Islanders, 14% of Cambodian Americans, and 13% of Laotian and Hmong Americans have 4-year college degrees, compared to 22% of Black Americans and 15% of Hispanic Americans. The stereotype that Asian Americans naturally excel at math and science also discourages Asian American students from pursuing careers in the arts and humanities, and keeps those who do pursue those careers from being taken seriously in their fields. A 2009 census report showed that under 15% of Asian American degree holders majored in the arts and humanities, less than any other racial or ethnic group in America. Limits on professional success. While Asian Americans are seen as professional success stories, very few are able to make it to the top of their fields, despite the education and qualifications that they are known for. A 2011 study showed that Asian Americans made up only 1.4% of Fortune 500 CEOs and 1.9% of all corporate officer positions, and 63% of Asian American men reported feeling stalled in their careers. While Asian Americans make up between 35 and 60% of the workforce in top tech companies like Google and Facebook, they are less than half as likely to reach management levels in the tech industry as their white counterparts. Hate crimes against Asian Americans. Hate crimes against all Asian American groups are given little attention in the United States. But because the model minority myth focuses so heavily on East Asians as the definition of Asian Americans, the alarming rise of hate crimes against South Asians is often ignored. General cultural ignorance about many South Asians makes them targets for violent Islamophobia, even if they are not Muslim. Since the terror attacks on September 11, 2001, many Sikhs and Hindus have reported being the victims of hate attacks by those mistaking them for Muslim Americans. In the first month after the attack, 300 hate crimes against Sikh Americans were documented by the Sikh Coalition. In the San Francisco Bay Area, 69% of turban-wearing Sikh students reported harassment or bullying in a 2008 survey. In 2012, a white supremacist opened fire in a Sikh temple in Wisconsin, killing 6 and wounding 4. Health and safety of Asian American women. The stereotype of the docile and subservient Asian woman is often used to encourage and hide abuse of Asian women by their partners. Between 41 and 61% of Asian American women will be physically or sexually abused by their partners in their lifetime, twice the national average for all women. Studies also show higher rates of depression and suicidal thoughts in Asian American women. Yet Asian American women are rarely the focus of domestic violence awareness, victim advocacy, or mental health efforts. Lack of political power. The stereotype of the meek Asian American, combined with social pressure to stick to science and technology fields, has discouraged many Asian Americans from seeking political leadership and activism roles, and prevents those who do seek those roles from being seen as strong enough leaders for the task. As of 2017, there is only one Asian American in the U.S. Senate, and only 11 Asian Americans in the House of Representatives. There has not been an Asian American president or vice president in the U.S., and there have only been 7 Asian American state governors in U.S. history so far. Everyday discrimination and microaggressions against Asian Americans. The model minority myth puts a lot of pressure on Asian Americans to seem happy with their great success in America and live up to the hardworking and docile image projected onto them. This makes it very hard for Asian Americans to complain about racist microaggressions against them, and makes it even harder for them to be taken seriously when they do. Common struggle with other people of color. Why can't you be like the Asians? They come here with nothing and work hard and make themselves into a great success. You aren't oppressed, you're just lazy. This is a common refrain that many non-Asian people of color hear from white people when they try to address systemic racism in America. The model minority myth is often used to separate Asian Americans from other people of color by using their perceived socioeconomic and academic success and docile nature to compare and contrast with Black Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Native Americans. This divide-and-conquer technique serves to redirect struggle against oppressive white supremacy to competition between Asian Americans and other people of color. The real animosity between some Asian Americans and other people of color that has been manufactured by the model minority myth prevents Asian Americans and non-Asian people of color from recognizing and organizing around shared experiences of labor exploitation, lack of government representation, lack of pop culture representation, cultural appropriation, and much more. This is just a small sample of the many ways in which the racist model minority myth harms Asian Americans. The model minority myth is not a myth designed to benefit Asian Americans. It was designed to benefit white supremacy through the exploitation of Asian American labor, the neglect of poor and disenfranchised Asian Americans, the exotification of Asian American culture, the exclusion of Asian Americans from systems of power, the sexual exploitation of Asian American women, and the comparison of the model minority status of Asian Americans to other racial minorities in order to delegitimize the claims of oppression and the struggles of Black and Hispanic Americans. If you want to fight racism in America, you have to fight the model minority myth. Far too often, this wide-reaching form of racism is left out of our discussions on issues of racial oppression and discrimination. Far too often, our Asian American friends and neighbors are not offered a seat at the equality and anti-racism table. And far too often, their own efforts at combating anti-Asian racism are ignored by the broader social justice community. Non-Asians must try to prioritize Asian American issues and voices, just as we should prioritize the issues and voices of other racial minorities in not only our social justice efforts, but also our government, our boardrooms, and our film and television screens. We must be willing to listen and learn when we are called out for our anti-Asian microaggressions and our complicity in the model minority myth. We must be willing to fight the white supremacist narrative designed to divide Asian Americans from other racial and ethnic groups in the U.S., and to fight for their freedom and equality as we do our own. And finally, Asian and non-Asian people of color must stop believing the hype. We are not in competition for the biggest slice of the white supremacist pie. We will never be free until we are all seen and valued for our unique culture, history, talents, and challenges. We cannot win this battle against racism if we do not realize that there is no set of racial or ethnic stereotypes that will set us free, no matter how appealing they seem on the surface. Chapter 15. But what if I hate Al Sharpton? When I was a kid, I liked Martin Luther King Jr., and I did not like Malcolm X. Those two thoughts were always linked for me. There were two sides to the fight for racial justice. MLK was on one, Malcolm was on the other. Malcolm and Martin had always been presented in this dichotomy to me and to many other Americans. Martin was on the side of love and equality. Malcolm was on the side of anger and separation. This was taught in school and in popular culture, and even at home. Martin Luther King wanted a world without color, people would also say. Malcolm X hated white people, they would also say. We learned all about Martin Luther King, the pacifist, who loved America into racial harmony. We heard cherry-picked segments of his speeches, talking about little black and white children living in peace. We saw King walk side by side with white people on the path to a post-race America. Malcolm, we saw, as the cautionary tale. What could happen if you let your bitterness at racial oppression get to you? We saw Malcolm as a man corrupted by hate that made him no better than his oppressors. Whereas Martin's death was seen as the martyrdom of a legend, Malcolm's death was no more than a natural consequence of being black and angry. This same Martin/Malcolm dichotomy is applied to all people of color, and especially black people, who fight for racial justice. A few of us are good and worthy of support. Those of us who manage to say, not all white people, enough, who manage to say please, who never talk of anger, who avoid words like justice, who keep our indictments abstract and never specific, we are the Martins. Those of us who shout, who inconvenience your day, who call out your specific behavior, who say black loudly and proudly, we are the Malcolms. And while the image of Malcolm X has been swapped out for the image of Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson, the impact of being labeled as such is the same. You are not worthy of support. Your cause is corrupt. You are why people will not fight for you. This is a message I receive on a regular basis. I receive Facebook comments, Twitter DMs, and emails telling me that people like me are the reason why race relations are as bad as they are. My insistence on voicing my anger, on using terms like white supremacy and racist to define white supremacy and things that are racist, my insistence on being seen and acknowledged as black, that is the real issue. White people would love to join me in my fight for freedom and justice, but I've made it too unpleasant for them. These comments used to sting. They used to take me aback. They called to all of the messaging that I and so many other black people had been inundated with their entire lives. There are black people who deserve equality and black people who don't, and if you don't, you have nobody to blame but yourself. I would second-guess myself, check my language, quiet my voice, but a quieter, gentler voice did not bring a quieter, gentler world. All it did was give people the impression that I was okay with living like a second-class citizen. All it did was increase my burden. But here's the thing. Martin Luther King was not the MLK of his time, not the MLK of legend. Martin Luther King was public enemy number one, seen as an even greater threat by our government and a large portion of society than Malcolm X was, because what Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X fought for was the same, freedom from oppression. At times they used different words and different tactics, but it was their goal that was the threat. Their goal of freedom from racial oppression was and is a direct threat to the system of white supremacy. And for all of Martin's actions of peace and love, he was targeted with violence, harassed, arrested, blackmailed, followed by the FBI, and eventually murdered. For all of the pedestals MLK is now put on, far above the reach of ordinary black Americans, Martin was in his life viewed as the most dangerous man in America. Martin was the black man who asked for too much too loudly. Martin was why white America couldn't support equality, because no matter what we ask for, if it threatens the system of white supremacy, it will always be seen as too much. When we were slaves nursing their babies, we were not nice enough. When we were maids cleaning their homes, we were not nice enough. When we were porters shining their shoes, we were not nice enough. And when we danced and sang for their entertainment, we were not nice enough. For hundreds of years, we have been told that the path to freedom from racial oppression lies in our virtue, that our humanity must be earned. We simply don't deserve equality yet. So when people say that they don't like my tone, or when they say they can't support the militancy of Black Lives Matter, or when they say that it would be easier if we just didn't talk about race all the time, I ask one question. Do you believe in justice and equality? Because if you believe in justice and equality, you believe in it all of the time, for all people. You believe in it for newborn babies, you believe in it for single mothers, you believe in it for kids in the street, you believe in justice and equality for people you like and people you don't. You believe in it for people who don't say please. And if there was anything I could say or do that would convince someone that I or people like me don't deserve justice or equality, then they never believed in justice and equality in the first place. Yes, I am a Malcolm, and Martin, and Angela, Marcus, Rosa, Biko, Baldwin, Asada, Harriet, and Nina. I'm fighting for liberation. I'm filled with righteous anger and love. I'm shouting as all before me have in their way. And I'm a human being who was born deserving justice and equality. And that is all you should need to know in order to stand by my side. We will never get anywhere if you are going to resort to insults. This is why nobody wants to help you. If you want white people to help you, you should be nicer to them. Why are they so angry? It makes it hard for people to support them. Let's talk about tone policing. If you've had conversations about social justice on the internet, you've likely heard this term. When I talk about tone policing with people online or in person, I find that many people don't fully understand what it means. They just know that it's not something they want to be accused of. Maybe tone policing is something you've been accused of yourself. You were having a conversation about race and things started to get heated. You were just trying to keep things calm and civil, and bam! You've been found guilty of tone policing. You've been found guilty, and you aren't quite sure how. But suddenly, you have been deemed the problem. What gives? Tone policing is an important term to understand if you want to have productive conversations about race. And if you have been tone policing, you've been doing something harmful, whether you mean to or not. So what is tone policing? Tone policing is when someone, usually the privileged person, in a conversation or situation about oppression, shifts the focus of the conversation from the oppression being discussed to the way it is being discussed. Tone policing prioritizes the comfort of the privileged person in the situation over the oppression of the disadvantaged person. This is something that can happen in a conversation, but can also apply to critiques of entire civil rights organizations and movements. Most damagingly, tone policing places prerequisites on being heard and being helped. You may be reading the above and thinking, well, that sounds like a healthy way to avoid stressful and harmful conversations. Isn't that how we're taught to handle people who are treating us with disrespect? Aren't we supposed to stand up for ourselves if people are being mean or rude? First, let me be clear that accusations of tone policing don't apply to actual abuse. Threats and violence are not okay. Neither is bringing more oppression into the conversation as a weapon against oppressors. Say, using ableist slurs in response to racism. But hurt feelings and rudeness are not oppression and will always come second to the oppression being discussed. For a simple disagreement about, say, who should take the garbage out, it would be reasonable to insist that people don't start shouting. But conversations on race and systemic oppression are never that simple. This isn't your typical household or workplace argument. No discussion about racism is just about one incident for people of color, because we cannot divorce ourselves from the past pain of systemic racism or the future repercussions of current abuse. When people of color talk about systemic racism, far more than feelings have been hurt, and far more than feelings are at stake. When people of color are talking about racism, no matter the immediate subject, they are also always talking about lifelong abuse at the hands of society. When I talk about police brutality, I am talking about the pain of seeing black men and women shot like dogs in the street. The fear for myself and my brothers and sons. The rage that we won't see justice. When you talk about oppression with oppressed people, you are talking with hurt, scared, angry, and grieving people. If you've been privileged enough to not suffer from the cumulative effects of systemic racism and are therefore able to look at racially charged situations one at a time and then let it go, please recognize that very few people of color are able to enter into discussions on racism with the same freedom. When people of color speak out about systemic racism, they are opening up all of that pain and fear and anger to you. They are not doing this because they enjoy it. It is an incredibly painful and vulnerable experience. We do this because we have to, because systemic racism is killing us. And yes, that pain and fear and anger will sometimes show in our words and our actions. But to see all that pain and how we fight still after entire lifetimes of struggle, and then to tell us to be more polite, is just plain cruel. To refuse to listen to someone's cries for justice and equality until the request comes in a language you feel comfortable with is a way of asserting your dominance over them in the situation. The oppressed person reaching out to you is already disadvantaged by the oppression they are trying to address. By tone policing, you are increasing that disadvantage by insisting that you get to determine if their grievances are valid and will only decide they are so if, on top of everything they are already enduring, they make the effort to prioritize